Good morning, everybody. So we have, I'm just going to give first names: John from Fairmount Capital, Chris from Vantage. We have Lorenzo from Leadenhall, Patty from Swiss Re, and we have Philip from Howden Tiger, right? And so just to set the tone for this panel, we've had several rough years in the market, punctuated by Hurricane Ian. And now the cat bond market is going to be expected to support roughly a doubling of the issuance volume this year, right? And it's obviously early, but it looks like that's going to get pulled off. So it's a good time to talk about resetting expectations among investors, sponsors, and catastrophe modelers. We threw that in. So I'm going to open up each one of these topics with kind of a somewhat provocative statement and ask for a reaction from the panel, and then we're going to have a discussion. So first is investors, and I say, and it was interesting with ChatGPT. You notice that ChatGPT got confused between catastrophe bonds and collateral re, right? So here the first statement is that cat bonds are distinct. They are different than collateralized re, and that's a good thing. So yeah.
We had a discussion earlier because I was arguing whether it was a good statement to start with or not. I mean, they are different, but they are equally good. So that's, I think, the most important element here. I mean, obviously, collateralized reinsurance has suffered more volatility recently, but there are some managers that have done very well out of it. There are different ways you can play it. You can stay more out of the money, closer to the money, or closer to the intention of the sponsors. Now, cat bonds have delivered, in some cases, better return. But then again, there are investors that don't need liquidity on a risk-adjusted basis. They always look better if you have like a mixed portfolio. And I think recently, through a process of re-underwriting, I mean, until 2017, everyone looked good in terms of the ILS managers. I mean, we didn't really have many catastrophes. But post-2017, everyone has been able to actually go through their portfolios and cherry-pick the counterparties they probably outperformed compared to others and reposition and obviously apply the lessons learned, which is really what investors wanted to hear. Plus, there is an element of transparency, right? Sometimes in the cat bond market, you talk about this liquidity, and then we see that obviously post-event, there is a lot of volatility in terms of the valuation of the bonds. And you have to immediately crystallize a mark-to-market loss. In the private placement market, there is a discovery period, and you suffer less volatility, especially, again, if you are out of the money. Now, in the U.S., it's tricky because you go and talk to investors, and everyone wants high double-digit returns. And even if you talk about collateral trapping, use of side pockets, and so on, they say, "Well, I want double-digit returns. I want to go for high-octane stuff." So of course, that's where collateralized re sometimes suffer, right? But.
Sure. Right. I mean, a lot of issues here. So I've noticed at these conferences, it's so complex because who's the audience? Who are we talking to here? And here I'm talking effectively to ChatGPT. The broader world actually doesn't understand there is a difference. And I have children, so it's like both of them are like my children, but my children are very different. They're very, very different from each other. I love them all equally. So I love the collateral re side. I mean, I do $1 billion of collateral re myself, right? And I very much enjoy engaging in that market. But here it's a cat bond session, and cat bonds are different. You talk about, I think there's much more volatility in the cat bond market side in terms of price, right? But I would say that investors kind of like that because it's actually mark-to-market. It's where it's trading. The price may be silly where it's trading, but it's trading there, whereas they feel that the collateral re side is more of a mark-to-model. There's an expert opinion about the impairment level on that, but for them, they feel less. They'd rather have a crazy volatile publicly trading price than an expert opinion that they don't know how to evaluate themselves. And I guess that's in part what I mean by it's different.
Can I make a comment? So I've been trading carbons for many years.
Yeah.
And that's really the highlight for me, to differentiate. And I'm not saying it's better or worse, but the tradability of the of carbons is very different from collateralized RE or traditional reinsurance. So that adds, as John said, volatility, but it adds opportunity to, right, for managers. And also, it's, the price discovery is much more dynamic than probably in the collateralized reinsurance. So, you know, there's room and a place for everything, but I think that's really the highlight. Another one, another difference I would say is the multi-year structure. Probably is very specific to cat bonds, or more specific. And that, maybe we can see in the next topic too, about sponsor, that really is high value, I would say, for sponsors to access the market and multi-year capacity. So it comes with uncertainty in the sense we don't know where the market is moving in the next 2 years, but I think it's great to have that access for sponsors.
Yeah, but if you don't need liquidity, I mean, you're better off just hold to your position, right? So irrespective of where the bond trades.
In terms of trading, you mean?
Yes.
Yeah.
So.
But, you know,
I mean, at the end of the day, they are the same, right? I mean, in the carbon market, you have the extension mechanism when there is an event that occurs close to the maturity of the bond that locks in your capital anyway. So they're the same as collateralized RE, right? They provide the same. I mean, they complement each other. Mm-hmm. I mean, that's the reality of it. And then as an investor, if you don't need the liquidity, you don't really mind whether the discovery period, you know, is the same for both at the end of the day. Actually, you know, the fact that you have more time for the collateralized RE maybe than a cat bond, it gives you more certainty that if you're able to recover value, you will recover it. Whereas in the carbon market, at one point, you need to close it. But, I mean, as I said, I mean, the important point here, John, is that we're not saying that one is better than the other, right? That's, we're saying is that... We can grant access to investors through different tools, instruments, which help the market overall, which is very important. And there are managers now that are very experienced in both carbons and collateralized RE and can deliver value. And I think today, I mean, or today, now is the time. You know, we need capital. And I know that you're also on the road a lot, like me.
Sure.
And we need to convince investors that there is an opportunity out there.
Right.
And then it really comes down to investors' preference. So I think, is it liquidity? What's the duration profile? I mean, I think at the end of the day, it comes down to risk-adjusted return expectations as well. And I think the obviously the kind of detailed assessment may be needed for more collateralized retype structures, which might be maybe more cumbersome than for more plain vanilla cat bond structures, I think is one which I think investors increasingly differentiate for. The other perspective is obviously the sponsor side, and I think on the sponsor side, and I think, Paddy, you mentioned it, I think there's room for both, and I think it's kind of our job and others, I think, to explain the differences and to some degree be agnostic to where the capital comes from, understanding that there are multi-year considerations on the cat bond, shorter durations, maybe different layers, more on the collateralized RE side. So I think I would echo that they are two distinct products, and I think the growth over the last 10 years have shown that both of them have been continuing to grow.
And by the way, we are also very active in cat bonds, right? I mean, it's not that we only deal. I mean, our cat bond fund was positive last
you
year.
You love both the markets. I get that.
We get that.
And there's plenty of opportunity for both products, right? I mean, the cat bond, I think Artemis is almost as old as the first cat bond issued. Congratulations, Steve. 4 years. But, you know, it's been a while. It's been a long road. I think the journey towards convergence continues.
Yeah.
And there's plenty of opportunity. You've talked about pricing. There's discipline, there's structural discipline around the cap bond market that doesn't exist in some ways in the collateralized or in the traditional reinsurance market.
Okay, now we're hitting on something
here. So there's something to be learned from cap bonds that we need to sort of, you know, bring to bear in the whole traded. Yeah, trade.
I think it's happening already, right?
It's happening, yeah.
We're having a hard
courtesy of investors in cap bonds.
Which
who
way,
have,
though,
demanded
Lorenzo?
It.
I mean, is the collateral getting, in a sense, closer to the cap on market, or is the cap on market getting closer to collateral RE?
I think it's both ways, to be honest, right?
We just raised $1 billion at Vantage to write collateralized reinsurance. And look to the cap
pair for me, please.
Yeah, what are you doing on this panel? You should be on market.
I could be on that one too. But no, but the cap on market has informed us, you know, in terms of what issues investors care about, whether they're collateralized reinsurance investors or cap bond investors, and things like extension premium and collateral hold provisions need to be addressed across the marketplace for both markets to grow. And we all have to grow. We're, what is it, 53% disaster gap? We had $313 billion of disasters last year, and we've insured 120 billion of them. So there's a lot to be done here, and I think cap bonds play a huge role in addressing that gap.
I mean, the typical trade-off, let's say, between cap bonds and collateral is very oriented towards the needs of the protection buyer, mm-hmm. right? Let's just face it. And the cap bond market is a little bit more, is much more sensitive to the needs of the investor base. Mm-hmm. So, I mean, this is historically, right? And so you had more simplified structures, et cetera. The cost was that you weren't necessarily addressing all the needs of the sponsor, right? You were forced to boil it down to the essence of the need, but not all of the need. Do you think that that's still the case today?
But that's also part of the design, right, of cat bonds. As cat bond investors don't receive the same amount of data transparency as collateralized insurance. So it's a trade-off, right? You cannot fulfill all the needs of the sponsor if investor manager don't get that level of transparency. So I think that kind of drives the design and the simplification of the carbon structures. And they have a place, in the market. They serve a purpose. They are complementary to everything else. But I don't think we should push to really a carbon to be closer to collateralized risk structures unless we also get that level of transparency around exposure.
That's a good point, Patty. I mean, we issued a cap bond right out of the blocks. We were barely up and running and issued a cap bond because we saw the access to that capital is essential to our business needs. And it was a less than ideal coverage. It was not a all perils, UNL type indemnity coverage. But we still issued $225 million of Vista 1 and continued with Vista 2 the next year, seeing it as essential to get the product that, as Patty says, is as well sculpted as it can be for the investor's needs, but less than ideal for a sponsor, but better than what else is out there for sure.
Okay, here's a challenge for you. In the old days, you'd walk into somebody's office and say, hey, you want to issue a cap bond? And the person would say, well, let's see, you offer me less and you charge me more. I think the answer is no, get out of my office and that'd be it, right? But so Vantage is brand new. You're straight out of the gates, no legacy issues. The world is all ahead of you. Very, very, very bright future. Very interesting situation. And straight out of the gates, you issue a catastrophe bond, which offered you less coverage and maybe even cost you more. There's a lot of effort that's involved.
Absolutely.
In that.
It wasn't necessary. It wasn't regulatory driven. It wasn't rating agency driven.
Yeah, no one was asking.
It was really management, risk management driven. We have, we happen to have expertise when you've got Aurora Swithenbank as your CFO, who's a longtime, a proponent of collateralized re and cap bonds. Bobby Anderson's our chief counsel. You've got expertise in house that knows what to do and knows how to access that market. And it's a long term, Patty said, it's a 3-year protection. That was essential to us as a startup, that we'd have that knowledge of as we grow our business, that we'd have that protection going out multi-years. You can't get in the traditional market.
So it's different enough that you really can't make, it's apples and oranges, right? You can't make a statement that it's more expensive. It's different.
It's different. I agree with that.
Obviously, you guys wouldn't have gone through the trouble of doing all this.
Yeah.
I think it's still remarkable. So I think it's subtle. ChatGPT can't get the difference, but I'm telling you, I just spent 2 weeks in Europe, city a day, and I spoke to, in some days, 100 investors a day, right? And they're like ChatGPT. They really don't know the difference between collateral. I think that people in our industry have talked too much about the commonalities between the two, which is fine, because there's a crazy amount of commonality. But they are different. They are distinct. And I think it's time that that we reset that expectation going forward. Without getting too involved into the art. I mean, it's two different children that we both love equally, but their personalities are different. They are quite different beasts. And as we'll talk about even more later in this session here, I think that this kind of, these statements, and that's a real story, right? Being thrown out of an office, and it's just like, you offer me less coverage and you charge me more. Why? And it's like, well, it's different. But you don't get to say that. You're only saying that as security is like dragging you out the door. That that it is different. So, but then, Philip, you actually said something too. You said that it is different in a way that, what I didn't quite catch what you were saying. You were saying about, was it about the performance characteristics or was
it? Well, I think it's the risk adjusted. I think Lorenzo, you mentioned that as well. So, I mean, I think the achievable returns in a cat bond portfolio versus a collateralized REIT portfolio generally target different kind of return.
It's a more spectrum. Remote risk.
Correct. Right. And again, I think that comes down to investor preferences. And that's the same with liquidity profiles. I think there are some who value that more and others who value that kind of less. So, and I think certainly, and I think the last point, and I'm sure that that's maybe also the feedback you got in your investor discussions, is obviously track record and performance has in the cat bond space been very robust over the last few years, also driven partially by that the event sizes have not reached kind of that level where a lot of these deals kind of are attaching, but that the side effect I think is indeed that there's more capital being interested in cat bond like type strategies as well, next to collateralized REIT.
Right.
But also collateralized REIT out of the money have done very well.
Exactly.
Right.
Over the last 5 years, so.
Lorenzo, I want to pick up on something. You talk about, you said a few statements about liquidity. You don't need liquidity. I have a lot of clients that don't need liquidity, mm-hmm. but they like the cap on side because it's mark to market. It's, you know, it's where it trades, not so-called mark to model or mark to expert opinion. So I think that's another distinction that should be made. The cap ons aren't special just because you can trade them. You know, and by the way, there's a lot of complaints about where you can trade them, right? Mm-hmm. But the fact that they are traded and the mark is based on the trading action in the market, and they actually do take a lot of comfort in that, even though they don't so-called need liquidity.
Yeah, right? But once you explain them that the person that gives the price to the bond doesn't know more than other people that are dealing with collateralized REIT or the sponsor, then they understand that doesn't really make a difference.
Oh, how do you mean? Sorry, say that again. Yeah. You're talking about the expertise of the people.
The expertise. So the person that is actually, so you have Arik and Ian that is about to make landfall, right? And everyone is obliged to send the pricing sheet on the Friday, and suddenly you see bonds that are trading with like 20 to 80 or to mm-hmm. 30 to 60.
Sure.
Right. Yes, investor can get comfort that there is an independent pricing, but they also understand that that price doesn't mean anything, right?
Well, okay, so that's a great example, though. Would you say that tends to mark the bond lower than it would otherwise?
No.
They
end up in the same difficult-to-value position. So it's the same as a private placement. In private placement, you end up in a difficult-to-value position, which is, you know, the outcome, if it lasts forever, is the use of a side pocket if you have inflows or outflows in a fund. But, you know, the cat bond... at the same thing, right? I mean, you crystallize a bid and you just need to wait, because if you don't want to, then sometimes you see some trades, you don't know how people can actually trade based on the fact that there are no information out there. So I see your point. I mean, there is always a discussion about valuation, and there are independent firms that can also provide you independent valuation on the private placement, right? An investor can get comfort either. It's just that the reality is after an event, everyone, you know, no one knows. Exactly. So it's the same thing.
But that's why the bid offer spread is so wide. That's okay. I mean, I'm not too...
Yeah, there's nothing wrong with that.
There's nothing wrong with that. Yeah. It reflects the market and actually incentivizes all the market players to see.
In fact, our role is to immediately inform investors, say, look, don't get shocked. I mean, it's just part of the uncertainty of the market. It's normal. Yeah. I mean, if you explain that before they invest... then they're usually okay with it. And in fact, you know, we all recouped, I mean, all these mark-to-market losses within, you know, by the end of the year, we all came back, right? So it was not a drama in the end.
Right. But I'm just emphasizing that that difference is significant. Here you keep talking about from an informational point of view, they don't know more than. But these investors, by the way, aren't naive. They know that markets don't magically know the answer spontaneously better than the experts do and so forth, but they still do show a preference for that. They'd rather have a bad mark on where it's trading, in a sense, in terms of value, than an expert opinion. In some cases, not all cases.
Okay, right. Because that's not my experience.
Right. Yeah. Is that right? Oh, interesting. Okay, very good.
Yeah, I mean.
Okay, good. So maybe I'll move on to sponsors. Another provocative statement. Patient, consistent engagement with investors is rewarded. Sponsors who patiently and consistently engage with investors are rewarded, let's say in the long run. So that's my prompt. I know that some people have some things to say about that.
I think maybe I can start and then others can kind of jump in. Also, I think one, I mean, I would certainly echo that repeat sponsors are, there's a difference in that sense of the reception of the marketplace. And again, I think that's also a function of obviously how well investors understand the portfolios of a new sponsor and the approach to it. So I think that's kind of statement number one. I think statement number two, and I think you said at the beginning, or I think that there's a potential opportunity for the cap bond market to double this year. I think we would fully echo that this could be a transformational year for the ILS market. I think there's enough demand out there from a capacity perspective. I think the tricky bit is really matching that demand with capital. And I think we have seen certainly in Q4 last year, going back to 2020 when COVID started, times in the marketplace where the certainty around price, but I think even more importantly around capacity, has been not fully clear for sponsors which are embarking on a cap bond journey, which takes kind of 3 to 4 months to complete. Also, I think the open dialogue, I think, between kind of firms like us and investors is I think crucial to make sure that actually we can get to that point, though, because it is, and I think you mentioned that example being thrown out of an office when you kind of make these comments. I think even outside of price, so it's really also execution, I think it is, especially when we're looking at indemnity bonds. I think, the workload which kind of stands behind that and the time it takes to put these deals together, especially for companies who can issue multiple hundred millions of dollars, is pretty substantial. And I think the cat bond market, I think, historically has done an okay but not great job in kind of matching supply and demand. And I think, again, this is I think, a unique year where, traditional reinsurance market is calibrating itself, increased demand because of inflation and other reasons. I think the cat bond market in particular, I think, is very well kind of destined to hopefully kind of benefit from that trend, but it requires, I think, management on both sides. Because I think what we have seen in the past, like I said, I think Q4 is a good example. Even repeat sponsors have not been able to even renew their capacity, and I think that's obviously something which is which makes people question how robust that marketplace is. Again, I mean, I think there's good arguments why 2023 is going to be different. But that's, I think, something we all need to continue to work on.
I think that, you know, liquidity has been an issue across the capital markets, right? It's not just the carbon market, so I don't think, you know, sponsors should be worried about it. I mean, it's not just us. So, but it's clear that, you know, we are all working very hard to find more capital, right? Because it's a great entry point for investors, so.
Yeah. Right.
But I would say that I agree. Repeat sponsors probably get treated a little better, or maybe they're higher in the pipeline or where manager may want to do investments. It's a factor also of getting to know the sponsors over many years, trusting them in terms of reporting, business plans, you know, how their exposure grows, so there's much more understanding, right? So there's not much, so much initial work to try to understand, say, a new sponsor coming in a very tight capacity market. And yes, so I think we need to all work toward building that kind of momentum in the market to make it sustainable, right? In a sense, like there is capacity, there is sponsors. As managers, investors, maybe there is a lot of uncertainty also around pipelines. It's not like traditional insurance renewals where you know exactly what you're going to renew, your deals. So for us, I mean, I guess for everybody, it's just very uncertain to know, okay, what's coming and who's coming. And I, as a manager, I would not want to see sponsor coming only when the price is right or in an opportunistic way. Mm-hmm. So I think we both sides have to commit in a way, right? And we have to find a
Yeah, I think
balance
the dependability of the renewal cycle, even in the traditional market, is very fractious.
Yeah.
I think there are a lot of client companies, sponsor companies, who aren't really sure what their, you know, their mm-hmm. risk profile looks like now that they've gone through yeah. the sort of the blinding 1-1 renewal and have taken increased retentions and you know, with all the factors we've talked about, demographics, inflation, climate, you know, are reassessing what they yeah. need. So I think I would challenge, it's interesting to hear that there's that much interest from investors in cap bonds. I would suggest that product development, what Philip touched upon, is probably something that needs to be addressed somewhat for that expansion to really happen. That sort of miss. You know, we issued the cap bond. It was an industry weighted. We're a reinsurance company. That's all we could issue. But if I was an insurance company, I would want to look for indemnity coverage. It might not have to be as broad as all perils. But you know, we tested that out a little bit at 1-1, and the market seemed to push back on the idea of, you know, single peril coverage at certain levels mm-hmm. of the risk curve. So I think product development on the cap bond space would really help go a long way to bringing more sponsors into the fold.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and I think it's also a question on how to bring new sponsors to the market. I mean, I think we have brought a number of new sponsors to the market last year, for example, in the cat bond market, and I think really, and I think it goes back to Paddy, your point, ensuring that investors understand these companies or the portfolios, the approach, I think is pretty crucial to get kind of as close as possible to the repeat sponsor status, but fully agree, obviously, a sponsor which has accessed the market repeatedly, I think, is obviously has built up a certain certain feedback and history.
Yeah, I think there is consensus that repeated sponsors are always, you know, preferred versus new sponsors, you know, because obviously they build track record and you trust, but you know, the point that you made about the visibility of the pipeline, I think, is also key, right? Because you have obviously money, you know, you want to deploy, you have a certain portfolio composition, and obviously there are some regulatory constraints that don't allow you and the other firms to give many details about what the pipeline is going to look like. And so it's also difficult for the ultimate ILS manager to think, okay, I'm going to keep some capacity for that repeated sponsor whilst, you know, I think whether or not to invest in this new sponsor issuance, right? So that's probably one of the challenges.
But I think that predictability of, and again, I think that there's really two elements. One is price, but I think it's almost more important on the capacity side. Or I think there's, which I think is holding still back a number of, especially larger sponsors in this marketplace. And again, I think hopefully with all the work being done on investor inflows, that is something we can give everybody more comfort with. But that just requires more dialogue.
The question for the panel. So, I mean, Paddy, you mentioned opportunistic issuers, right? They're in and out, and they're obviously coming in when yields are low, yield spreads are low, right? I mean, so now you've got new sponsors coming to the market when yields are at all-time highs. Do you think that many of those will become repeat issuers? Or they're actually just doing it now because, you know, they're not getting enough capacity on the traditional reinsurance side? The market will normalize, right? It always does. Capital will inflow. Then do they go away, or do you think they actually end up staying?
I will hope they stay.
Yeah, we hope they stay.
Well, I think, and that goes back to the comment I made about this being potentially a transformational year. So I think there's more recognition from the sponsor side that ILS can be indeed a fundamental pillar of your reinsurance strategy. And I mean, I think we have frankly not seen many opportunistic sponsors which come yeah. and never come again. No, I think, I mean, they're all, I mean, some might wait until their deal matures or so, but I think there's the list of people who came to the cap bond market once and never again is very, very mm-hmm. small. So, and like I said, just given that also the reinsurance market is recalibrating its appetite, I think there's a recognition that ILS could be indeed a cornerstone of your reinsurance strategy, and which hopefully creates a great platform for this market to continue to grow. But investors, I think, need to also obviously be supportive of these deals and the sizes that they're being offered at.
Yeah, a hard traditional reinsurance market should definitely, you know, push all the sponsors to consider the different ways to find protection. So I think it would be fool as a, you know, as an insurance buyer not to think about a car bond when I already struggled to get terms and conditions they wanted in the traditional market. Mm-hmm. And similar to what Chris mentioned, right? He obviously had difficult access to the capital market, and he thought actually, you know, car bond seems like a good way if I can compromise on certain features. Mm-hmm. And you know, so that's his usual supply and demand. So I believe, yes, we should see more and more, right?
It's interesting to note, too, that, you know, we're talking about cat bonds here, but most insurance companies, you know, their property cat, while it's an important piece of their, you know, their earnings volatility, it's not, you know, sort of the scale of premium that they write, it's not a large piece of the premium for most, say, U.S. carriers. And so I think, interestingly, you might get more interest in sponsorship because there was the first cyber cat bond, you know, just issued, or there are other interested parties, interested investors in, you know, other lines than property cat. I mean, we're seeing it in the ILS space, but, you know, if it sort of percolates up into cat bond investor, I think that you might actually engage more sponsors, you know, more broadly for interest in a, you know, multi-line approach. That's what they like about traditional reinsurance companies. They are a multi-line partner and relationship. So some aspect of that, I think, might go a long way in showing the sort of the spread of interest among cap bond investors.
So that's interesting. We didn't really touch on this before in any pre-discussion. Cyber, seeing cyber come. No, that's great. So cyber risk is out in the market. We have our first cap bond deal.
Yep.
And you're saying that actually heightens the interest.
I would guess it would. I guess, you know, they'd be asking their brokers what, you know, what other lines of business would be of interest to investors, and, you know, I think it's just an interesting sort of, you know, way to open up the dialogue with more sponsors.
Okay, very interesting. Yeah, so, and I guess you're making reference to the fact that in the traditional reinsurance side, a reinsurer engages the insurance company, not only just on the property cat That's side, right. but on the casualty side, et cetera.
Specialty.
Taking care of all those needs. Cat bond market really doesn't do that, but then cyber jumps on the radar screen. It's like, oh, okay, that's interesting. These cat bond investors might.
Yeah, I mean, it was interesting to me. I have to say, but you know, and there are other lines of business that might you know, avail themselves of the cat bond structure that, you know, have been explored but discounted. And again, if it's doubling in issuance or doubling in supply of investor interest, you know, it would be interesting to see if that can be a broader spectrum of risk.
Right. Okay. That's an interesting, maybe that's a good segue into cap modelers. So here, and I'm gonna involve the cyber issue here too. So, you know, cap modelers, of course, are in some sense the beating heart of the market, right? They are neutral actually. And they're sitting there trying to assess the risk as best as possible. They got lots of people shouting at them from every which direction. And I think they do a reasonable job of ignoring all that noise, assessing the risk. But the challenges are immense, you know. Now, a bright spot in that is that the cat modelers actually have emerged with a model or models that were sufficient to support a cat bond deal, you know. So that's a great example of innovation. But I want to talk about something maybe a little bit less exciting, which is dealing with all the stuff that they're having to deal. Secondary perils, social inflation, and climate change. And what I want to ask out loud is, you know, look into ChatGPT. It's like, the impression I'm getting is that the market's really confused about all these issues, that it's all getting mixed up. And I'm just wondering whether or not the cap modelers can play a role in resetting the conversation around these things. I find that they're all being mixed up. I don't know if you guys even agree with that.
I feel strongly about that. I think they are all mixed up. And I think cat modelers, I think, do a very good job of actually representing the risk to the best of the science out there and the abilities. I mean, models, I think this is one of the few asset classes out there that can actually quantify the risk in such a sophisticated way. So let's not forget that, the starting point. And then, you know, I started this career by being a cat modeler for Swiss Re. So I know, you know, the hazard part, for example, is just one of the components. It's, of course, very important. But then you add the exposure part, the vulnerability, the financial conditions. And maybe I will add now social inflation is also very important. So, yeah, let's not forget that, yes, we experience increased losses in the past few years, but climate change didn't start in 2017. It's been a long process. And, you know, when we are asked, are we modeling, are models including climate change, is also what is the question there really? Climate change, we're all agreeing, is happening, but it's really the modeling climate change is a long-term warming model. We're all agreeing that's happening. It's putting more energy, more moist, you know, in the system. And what can really CAT models do about that, right, to model the 1 year or 2 years ahead of us? So let's be, try to be scientific about it. Maybe there are features that can be included. I would say increased rainfall maybe is one. We know there is more moist, you know, in the system, so that can be reflected. But can CAT model really reflect? Do we think the increased frequency, there is increased frequency of event due to climate change or not? So we have to distinguish, and I think CAT modelers have to be maybe more vocal about explaining what can be included, what cannot be included. Every time there is an event, we learn something new. This is Mother Nature, is a highly entropic system, and we just, it's, you know, every time we learn something new because we deal with very extreme events and we cannot model exactly every event. So, and then all the other components are really important, like exposure, inflation, that is a huge component that can be quantified. And I would say maybe all those components have maybe, if I had to, you know, make a guess, is 80% of the loss increase is probably due to those quantifiable factors.
Sure. I mean, we're all practitioners in the field, and many people in the room are. So I don't think there's any confusion among practitioners.
Yeah.
Right? We know what climate change is. We all have our own ideas. They're not all the same, but what the marginal impact of that is on the risk. As you say, we all know that 80% of it is actually just the property exposure,
right,
growth itself. So we all understand those things there, but the broader public, I think, is actually getting a mixed message about the models. Here it sounds like you're defending the models. I do. But then you get, so this is something that kind of surprised me. It was in Artemis, of course, and it's a well-known firm that's, you know, terrific and knows the risks extremely well. But I felt was maybe a little bit overzealous in promoting, you know, their investment management services by saying that the modelers aren't getting climate change right, but we have scientists on staff and we get it right, which is why you should give us the money. I actually cringe when I see things like that, because I know that the broader public reads that as the models don't get climate change, which they're very paranoid about, mm-hmm, that. And I just don't agree, and I think that maybe that is something that we need to reset the expectations on. Unless some of you disagree, you think that the models aren't getting.
Yeah, we agree with Patty.
I think what Patty said about the quantification and the baseline that the models give you is important.
Yep.
I'm probably the only one old enough to remember when models actually came about with Karen Clark and Tom Hutton coming up with the idea of, why don't we count up the exposures? And we fast forward 20 years later, I lost a debate at Lloyd's to a famous Lloyd's underwriter, where I said I grew up underwriting on the models and under, you know, Iris 3.0, the whole thing. And he won the debate by saying his parting comment was, I don't need the models, I can feel it in my water. But so I'll never forget
that. What does that
even mean? I never heard that phrase before, but he won the debate amongst the Lloyd's 35s because he's a famous Lloyd's underwriter and a great guy. But and he was saying it sort of sarcastically, it does give you a baseline, that quantification that Patty mentioned. I would say that, you know, the models need to think about how to bring in more predictive analytics and more predictive modeling given these conditional issues that we're going to deal with short-term and long-term. So the example would be that when Winter Storm Uri happened in Texas, you know, to be able to model what that meant for the ensuing early hurricane season in Texas would have been different had Uri not happened, right? There were issues with losses, there's issues with infrastructure, there was issues with demand surge and inflationary issues that, you know, that's the sort of thing that I think would be interesting to be able to test against the models, but the baseline they give you, that stochastic view, is essential to how we underwrite.
So that's an interesting point. So I mean, as practitioners, we know that the model is a tool. You have to own the model and you have to use it, right? You don't just sit back and hit it, take the default result, and complain that it doesn't capture what you want to capture. It's up to you to do that. So we're all doing that. But has it gotten to the point where a lot of these practitioner adjustments need to be put into the base model? Yeah, is that maybe potentially part of the public narrative that the models aren't capturing all the risk? I mean, back to my slight annoyance at what investment manager said, but we're all saying that. You know, we say, oh, no, I never take the model as it is. I always make an adjustment, right? So, you know, my perception is that we're all making about the same adjustment, which is good, you know, because I think it's kind of clear what adjustments to be made. But is it time for the modelers to do a reset and take all those practices and shove that back into the baseline?
I think there's a big debate probably about how much underwriting needs to be done for these deals. And obviously, a lot of people here on the panel, I think, are probably would argue that there's a lot of alpha being created by having that ability to make those adjustments. Obviously, past performance will kind of ultimately tell. But I agree with Chris and with Paddy. I mean, I think the models currently provide a good baseline, but as John, you said, they're not providing an ultimate answer. And if they would, a lot of people in this room wouldn't be necessary to transact right. these transactions anymore. Can they? I think that's kind of a question. Or I think, can you capture inflation in exposure and others? You probably can capture a lot of those elements. Can you capture how well claim settlement works from company A versus B? Can you capture how well kind of the information entered into the models, how well that is kind of being handled? I think that's debatable. So I think there's a lot of more qualitative kind of judgments being made along the way, which I think, yeah, creates truly different approaches. And I think yeah. that's something which I think is going to be hard to capture
sure.
and be fully automated.
Yeah, I agree. I don't think model can. Because every deal is different too, right? That's part of the risk analysis. There's, you know, experience, what we call experience rate, exposure rate. So models are not really built to be perfect, you know, perfectly modeling every
sure.
portfolio out there. So on the hazard side, on the science side, yeah, model should update, you know, whenever there's a new event, that new information should go in. Modeling Paris like wildfire is much more problematic because that's something that probably ideally the model should be reviewed every year. That Paris may be something that needs a little bit more care.
Well, that's an interesting notion yeah. to review the model every year because
yeah.
I believe the cycle is much longer than that,
yeah.
right? You can see it's so exhausting from the
yeah,
review. It takes
about
3 to 5 years
yeah.
to recover from that process
yeah.
and do it all over again. But I think there are some. I think there is an adjustment of the baseline. I think I'd just like to see the modelers be more vocal about that. It was an unfortunate event in 2011, for those of you who will remember, where a major modeler made a bold and sincere update to their model, and you know, and let's not discuss about whether it was right or wrong and so forth. Just the change management wasn't there. And they were crucified for it,
mm-hmm.
right? And I think that the modelers have been shy ever since
yeah.
about making upward revisions and risk.
I think for 1 year, no one used them, you know, for cat bonds.
It was a death penalty. It was awful, and I felt very, very bad about it, you know. And I thought that was a negative long term for the market. But I do see some hopeful things. You know, I've been asking the modelers for years to actually make an estimate of what social inflation is doing in Florida, right? Just look at the loss data. It's just part of the
mm-hmm.
damage function. And, you know, I'm sure, I don't know if any of you noticed, but after Ian, you saw the modelers, when they were putting their loss estimate, they broke out what they thought the social inflation number was.
So
I was so happy and proud for them. I thought, okay, good, this is more like it. It's being surfaced. And I do think that secondary perils, talking about, say, tornado hail, for example, right, we've always known that originally in the models, Chris, when you were first using, you know, AIR, you ever noticed how the tornado hail was clearly just 1/6 of the actual loss experience?
Yeah.
It's because they couldn't fit that many events in the model without crashing it. It just couldn't fit
the market wisdom was that it can never be a tornado hail event greater than $1 billion.
Well, there was that too, exactly. I know. I think it was like a Fort Worth hit. It took out Dallas and Fort Worth.
Obviously not right.
But, well, I mean, the exposure grew like crazy, of course, mm-hmm. since those early days. But even given the exposure at the time, the models weren't able to capture it because you just couldn't put that many events in the model, right?
Yeah, it was 1974, Xenia was the event.
Right.
Yeah.
And so we would get cap-on deals that were modeled at a 1.5% expected loss, but paying a 13% yield. And this is before the hard market. Why? Because the whole market knew that the expected loss was more like 5% or 6%. So that's like 4x, 5x of what was coming out of the model. But I think that now that we've got more hard disk space, well, it's not even hard disk anymore, but you know, more memory, more computing capability, I see that the modelers are actually converging on where market adjustments are. The baseline is there. And I just wish they'd be more vocal about these changes that they're making.
But ultimately, I think the market is, I mean, like you said, I think there's market participants and different levels of sophistication in those participants as well. And I think especially in the cat bond market, given that a market clearing price is established at the end, I think that is I think, an additional benefit the market can provide, or where even investors who might not have that capability can kind of take some comfort in. And again, I mean, I don't think anybody's goals is that you will have a fully automated model where you can put something in, something comes out, because that I don't think there's any asset class which exists where that's actually the case. So, I mean, I think it's a multi-dimensional problem, and experts in the field, I think, can create value by understanding something better than what comes out of a standardized model.
Absolutely. At this point, I'd like to open it up to the audience to participate in this conversation. Does anybody have anything that they want to interject into what we've been talking about here?
Niraj?
There's got to be somebody. Okay, good. Yeah, Niraj, good.
Thanks. To see you.
Oh, wait, you got to get a microphone here.
I can yell. Yeah, so we talked about modeling from the perspective of property cat risk, but I was wondering if you could, any one of you can comment on the modeling in other lines. For example, you mentioned cyber a couple of times, but we didn't talk too much about that, or any other lines.
Right. So this is Niraj Patel, everybody. Yeah. And the question is just comment on models, and particularly even cyber risk. Okay, good. All right. Does anybody want to give that a shot? No.
Well, there's no, we go back to not quite to ChatGPT or AI, but there's new technology being brought to bear across all, you know, across all exposures, whether it's intellectual property, you know, cyber, other lines of business, and you know, I think that's exciting to be able to utilize and harness that new technology. Wildfire is another example of you know, technology being built fresh to address those risks. And you know, we Advantage are adopting that technology and being careful about how we deploy it, deploy our capacity behind it. But it's exciting because it's sort of the emerging you know, the emerging world of new modeling across multiple lines. And
Chris, are you publicly acknowledging that Vantage is taking cyber risk? Is that,
yes.
Is that what you are? Okay,
good. Absolutely. Yeah.
Okay, good. I mean, we're public about it. The cyber cap-on deal that was just recently done, we allowed them to put in the press release that Fairmat was the lead investor on that deal. Mm-hmm. So, it was interesting to see some investors in that deal specifically not wanting to be outed in that regard. They were, I believe they were afraid of what their investors' reaction would be. And it's a tiny, tiny, tiny part of their portfolio. So they figured, look, we can just throw that in the other bucket and not upset investors for now. I know it's a reluctance. I was half joking when I was comparing.
Yeah, no, I mean, you have to be cautious. Greg Hendrick, the CEO of Vantage, often talks about attacking idiosyncratic risk where the market is not, you know, not ready, but you know, be cautious, have technology, have partnership and expertise to address it, but and also allocate a small amount of your portfolio to that risk as we grow.
Right. Yeah, we've been researching it since 2015, Niraj. Yeah. So I joined a cyber risk consortium at MIT at the time, which was fascinating, because you would actually have these large companies come into a room, and they would actually just tell you about their cyber attacks. what had happened to the company. It's not in the news. And give you every gory detail. You know, and of course that's depressing because it just looks like nothing's secure. Anybody can get in anywhere. And then I went out and bought a cyber insurance policy for Fairmap. Figured that'll begin the research. That was depressing. I mean, they threw millions of dollars of coverage at me. They didn't ask a single question about what I was, and they charged $1,000 or something like that. And the terms and conditions are very loose. So I was like, okay, that's not that great. But now, by the way, we're paying 10 times more. The coverage was cut in half. There's tons of restrictions, sublimits, et cetera. But and I'm like, oh, that, you know, bad for Fairmap, but good for the market. You know, one fascinating thing: we have a full-time cyber security expert. So we have a head of cybersecurity full-time, and then we pay three companies to attack us constantly. You know, and they pride themselves in having, you know, 99.6% success rate. Everything's all buttoned up. But at the latest renewal for our cyber insurance policy, we went and approached three different markets, and they all have this automatic scan where they just kind of hit your network just to see from the outside, see if there's anything off. And one of them came back with a C rating on one of our aspects of our security. And I was like, well, that can't be right. And so I handed it to our guys, and they said, no, that's actually right. They actually found something that we had missed. The auto scan found something. It's very, very, very subtle. It's not super, super dire, but that auto scan actually found something that all the experts and everybody had missed, and it was an auto scan. But so that's kind of the state of the market. So premiums are up, you know, coverage is much more controlled. But I would say that the modeling, I think, is there, which is kind of a surprising statement. But and the way I explain it to people is that it's what I would call a top-down model. So everything else before the attempts were trying to synthesize to the risk from underneath. So the early models, you'd look at it and they'd say, well, that's a 1 in 1,000 year. And you're like, that's not a 1 in 1,000 year. I mean, your intuition tells you that. My water tells me different. What does that even mean? I don't know. Because now this model, and I'm gonna exaggerate, it'll say that's a 15% expected loss. Happens, you know, that would happen once every 6 years. And it's too high. But then you look at it and you see why, because it'll say, oh, you know, well, a lot of what's driving that is this scenario, say like a loss of the power grid's taken down. But then the policy excludes coverage for that. So that's the whole thing. The insurers are aware of the systemic risk. I think they're being very transparent about it too. It's like, look, we can't cover that. We can't cover the power grid going down across the entire United States due to a cyber attack. That's excluded. So you take that out, and then it goes from 15% down to 12%, and you keep looking at it. You confirm that the policy excludes that scenario, and you keep coming down. So you're coming from above the risk level down towards it, you know. And because the premiums are so high in the underlying market, you don't have to be too precious about it, right? It's not like, is it a 2% expected loss, a 3% expected loss? Everything hangs in the balance. No, it doesn't, because they're paying you a premium that's well above that. So I think that's why the market is starting to clear. And I would, you know, say quite simply, it's because we went from top-down modeling to the risk instead of bottom-up. That was the big breakthrough, in my opinion.
Yeah. Well, and we have seen similar trends in other lines. I mean, even simple things like flood, or others, and or terrorism. I mean, I think there's a very logical approach. I think cyber, a lot of work has been done over the last kind of 5 to 10 years on actually developing models, and I think it goes back to that underwriting approach again. I think ultimately it's not the model is not going to be the full gospel. There's going to be other considerations which I think investors bring to the table to assess that risk, and reinsurers have done this since the beginning, to assess unique risk and try to come up with a price at the end.
Okay, great, thanks. Yes, please. Well, let's see. Yep. Oh, there's Judy back there. Okay, good. Sorry, Judy, this gentleman was first here. Sorry, go ahead. Oh.
Okay. Thanks, hi, Maury Katz, BMS Re. Great panel, thank you very much. I think I heard some of this, but I want to go right at it. What is the investor appetite for property cat right now?
It's very high.
Question, yeah. What is the investor appetite? Yeah, it's extremely high.
It's extremely high. Yeah. I mean, it's... Now, I think, you know, there is definitely a consensus from talking to peers that we are getting a lot of meetings. The question mark is how many meetings does it take to convert?
Does that include personal lines?
A lot of questions as well. Sorry, say again.
Sorry, does that include personal lines?
Yeah, everything. I mean, there's... But, you know, we'll see. I mean, in 4 months, we meet again, I tell you.
Yeah. But, yeah, the interest is sky high. It's never been higher. I've never seen anything like it.
And the types of investors you guys are talking to are...
Institutional.
I mean, I would say, not to throw cold water on it, but it depends on what kind of investor you're talking to. And obviously, John and Lorenzo and Patty have, you know, access to investors who are keenly interested. The private equity world, I would say, is, you know, as an investor group, is not as, you know, keenly interested in property cat or volatile lines, right? You see that in the marketplace. So it really depends on what type of investor that you're looking for. But thankfully, there are a lot of institutional investors, I think, that are you know, keenly looking to fill the void.
Right.
I think the one challenge we're facing is that every asset class looks very attractive. Mm. So you have to bring it back to the obvious of diversification and a small percentage of your portfolio. But otherwise, they're all keen to listen, for sure. Then we need to see whether we can persuade them to add some of it to their portfolio.
Yeah. But Lorenzo says very interesting, right? That opportunities elsewhere are more attractive. If you really look at what happened in 2022.
I didn't say more attractive. I said as attractive.
I spoke too loosely about that, exactly. Well, many will say that. It's a big world, right? And I'm not there to dissuade them from that. But, you know, even if they think it's more, it's like, kind of, look, don't put all your eggs in one basket, right?
That's right.
Like, they may be hot on high yield or something like that, but they put some here. So, but I remind a lot of people that really what happened in 2022 is almost a superposition of the subprime crisis and Katrina. They both happened in the same year, effectively, you know, and that's why we have the hardest market conditions ever. It's like already the market was hardening from inflation. Inflation was causing insurance companies to conclude they have to buy more reinsurance, but the rate rises was hurting assets on the balance sheets of reinsurers, reducing their risk capacity. If you put those numbers together, it's huge. It's sort of global financial crisis like. It's different, but it's still big numbers. And then on top of that, you have a $50 billion hurricane. So it really is kind of a Katrina year and a subprime crisis year superimposed on top of each other. But the difficulty is that, yeah, our conditions are fabulous, but other people are looking at improved conditions, not better conditions.
But I think the other point to make, too, it is an asset class which requires a certain time dedication to really fully understand, and it remains. So I think that's probably, and I think Lorenzo said that from a interest versus actually investment is obviously a process to kind of go through.
The due diligence is definitely longer. Yeah. There's a lot to go through.
Well, the risk is more tangible, right? So I see in the news, so I think it triggers that kind of questioning and kind of cautiousness sometimes.
Right. But we are seeing people acting quickly as well. They're the exception, of course, because that's not usual. And I don't like it when I see an investor acting quickly, quick to come in and quick to come out, right?
Yeah.
But I did have a meeting with, this was possibly the most prepared analyst I've ever encountered. Very surprising. I'd only been working on it a couple of weeks, but I actually even knew like that PCS lost the initial estimates 6 weeks and 60 days thereafter. Just knew all the details. It wasn't showing off. And their process normally is 3 years on a new asset class like this before they put it in. That's their rule of thumb. They want to get to know all the players. They want to meet Lorenzo. They want to meet Patty or just everybody.
I can give him my card.
Yeah, I'll give you his name. I'll give you his name, okay? By the way, I think he's actually talked to you, so I think you know who it is.
Yeah, but, I hope so, because otherwise I miss him.
It was one meeting. It was very serious, and they emailed the next day. They're going to put in $300 million, just like that. So I don't want to say that that's typical, but it is indicative of the, you know, these high yields serve a purpose. It's a siren call for capital, right? It's, so it's coming in. Judy, actually, I want to.
My question sort of.
Could you get a microphone to you? Sorry, I think so, just for the recorded audience.
Hi. So my question was really meant prior to, is the capital coming in, asking you guys, but when I look at what the title is of the session, Resetting Expectation in Catastrophe Bonds, do we need to set reset expectation? And your end investors, when they look at your portfolio, you're a very, you know, one of the leading investors in the asset class, do they need to reset their expectations, or has it performed the way they expect it? Has it performed the way that you expected it to? I mean, I think, are you proud of, you know, your performance?
But I want to be careful. I mean, right now I'm looking pretty good, but you know, next year I could from top to bottom and be the most underperforming firm. It's just cap bonds. Yeah, it's funny you say this. So Judy, it's like, do you need to reset expectations with cap bonds?
Right.
I actually tried that on Steve, and he's like, that won't fly. That's not a session. We can't do that. And so so we came up with this. And I think that the nuance point that Steve was making to me is like, you know, people are confused between what, you know, the cap bond side of the market and the collateral read side of the market. So at the very least, I think there's resetting the expectations is more kind of just re-educating a lot of people that were taught that they really are just complete, they're the same. Just one's privately placed and maybe doesn't trade so much or doesn't trade at all, but...
But ultimately, are they the same? I mean, I heard a lot that the real distinction is liquidity. But is that really the only distinction? And I think about performance. And so I don't have visibility into the other market. But when we hear about fatigue from investors, and when I speak to investors and, you know, end investors, it's these new investors who haven't had the exposure who seem very willing to jump in. And I wonder, how do we get that fatigue? And is it the fatigue from the catastrophe bond? So in terms of setting expectations, it's just so that there's transparency.
Right. I was trying to get it out of the panel, but yeah, exactly. That's it is different.
Right, it is.
The client experience. Now, obviously, what I'm saying here is just horribly biased because, you know, I'm super heavy on cap bonds. So the investors are in that, and they have their own self-reinforcing view. But yeah, a cap bond that goes into extension and is trading at 20 cents on the dollar is different for those investors than a collateral recontract, and believe me, I have them, that, you know, has trapped collateral is going on. It's different actually from a government's point of view. See, that bond that goes in extension is just there. The maturity is extended, and it has a price that it continues to get marked at. So it's baked into the NAV. But the collateral recontract, they might want a weekly conference call initially and then a monthly call with an update about it. And it's very awkward, of course, right? Because there's no update often. It's the counterparty is deciding whether to release the collateral or not. So the way that percolates up to the investment committee is different, right? The bond, there's actually not, it's a non-event. The price is just different. But with the collateral recontract extension.
The information on the price of the CAD bond comes from the same information for the price of the collateralized RE.
Yeah. You're approaching it from, I understand that as a professional investor, we think about the informational content, but for these stakeholders, these clients, they think about, gosh, now we have to set 5 minutes aside in the next investment committee meeting to talk about all these collateral recontracts. And give them an update on the status, but they don't have to do it on the cap on side. It may be kind of, the underlying substance is the same, but the demands on their time, the bandwidth, upper management bandwidth, is different. And by the way, not all are complaining. You know, many are sophisticated. They're used to this stuff. They have private equity investments. It's not that big of a deal, but for some of them, it is. So, but I don't know. Thanks for your question, but it's a non-question, isn't it? It's like, do we need to even reset the expectations? And I think there's some subtle points that were made, but I think that it is a great time to do that. Yes, please. I think we have one. Actually, I haven't been looking over here. Is there any hands that have been going up over here? No.
Rebecca. Morning. Aaron Garcia from Hiscox ILS. Great panel. Thank you for that so far. Question, you talked about the differences between CAT and collateralized, and one that I found was missing was the level of collateralization. A CAT bond has to be fully collateralized. A collateralized B is like you can get some portfolio collateralization, and I was wondering if you have any thoughts on how investors see that.
Okay, Laura. So you're asking about leverage in a sense, right?
Correct. So the level of efficiency of one product versus the other.
Well, underwriting leverage rather than financing leverage, yeah. I think investors are happy with it, right? I mean, that's one also of the reasons why on a risk-adjusted basis, when you have a mixed fund of collateralized RE and CAD bonds, you get a better risk-adjusted returns. I mean, you're in a CAD bond fund, you get a tail of 0.5% VAR of a -40, -45, similar to the index, with an expected return in current market conditions, including money market rates at about 12.5%. If you look at similar level of tail risk in collateralized RE, you probably get 20%. So.
Is that what you were asking about? Does that kind of get to?
I was wondering how do you, so part of the discussion is that level of confusion for investors, and it's really not the same. And I agree with you guys. And I think like one key difference for us when we construct our portfolios is that like the need for fully collateralized a CAT bond, basically it's collateral that you set aside, versus being able to construct a portfolio on a like quite efficient way if you don't have to collateralize it, and how what's the level of understanding of investors on that, and how do they value those two different products?
I agree.
I mean, ultimately, you know, what I think. Every manager has been trying hard over the last 15, 20 years to bring investors or investors' money in a way that you can use their capital in the most efficient, you know, possible way, which should be closer to the traditional reinsurance balance sheet type of play. And that's why, you know, we all have our fronting arrangements. We have our ability to basically collateralize up to a certain level of confidence without recourse to the investors, which actually they love it. But, you know, obviously it's a deeper conversation. That's why I'm not sure how much time we have, but absolutely.
Sorry for that.
No, it's okay.
Yeah, but Lorenzo, you would say that any investor that finds that scheme attractive is also quite sophisticated and understands all the issues. I think the question is, do they understand that collateral is not fully collateralized?
Yeah, of course.
It takes a lot longer, to your point about sort of bandwidth at the management level or at the, you know, the investment committee level, is to explain that. I think the machine kind of had it right directionally in that it came up with a number for cap bonds. It was wrong, but it was a number. I bet you everybody on this panel knows what the number is. What's the number for ILS or for retro or for traded reinsurance? It's a very murky, because of that leverage, and it's a very kind of closed. So to try to explain that to investors, I think, is difficult. But that would be the challenge long term, as Lorenzo says, to bring us the cap bond market that is closer to the to replicating what that leverage balance sheet gives to the counterparties is going to take a long time.
Well, and that's part of the education element I kind of mentioned before, and the time and the diligence it takes for investors to understand the space. So there's the product, there's the risk return, and then there's financial leverage, structural leverage, and how to best optimize it against what the investor's risk return profile is. Because obviously leverage helps on the upside, but also has downside to come with that. There's different risk levels being accessed.
Everything else we spoke about is a choice.
Another panel.
Yeah. I think they definitely get the difference. Yeah. And there are those that find that collateral side very attractive for the reasons that it's not fully collateralized.
Right? I think that irrespective of how sophisticated an investor is, if at every first meeting everyone is transparent about collateral trapping and the use of side pocket, then they write it down. They keep asking you questions about it until they understand it. If they're comfortable about it, then they go forward. If they're not comfortable, then the conversation is over. But at least once you have a 2017 or 2018, then everyone was clear about the rule of the game. The problem we had is there was such an asymmetry of information between different managers giving just one side of the story because they were worried about, you know, mentioning the gray areas, because otherwise they wouldn't maybe raise money, and that caused, you know, the volatility that we saw, especially for the riskier type of play.
This is a perfect segue into Mark Gibson's session, which I think is next, isn't that right? All right, go ahead. So please give a hand to the panelists. Thank you.